Good morning. I will call the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee to order. Representative O'Neill, if you have the opportunity to review the minutes.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Representative O'Neill moves the minutes from March 2nd. Is there discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Members, the plan today is to hear as many bills as we can this morning, and then we will reconvene at 5:30 or the call of the chair in room 400 North. So that is the plan. And also wanted to let members know that we've extended the amendment deadline for Thursday's bill hearings to 4 p.m. on Wednesday, tomorrow. Since we have such these full agendas and bills are subject to being added, we wanted to give a little more opportunity for people to address amendments if need be. So with that, our first bill up this morning is House File 2058, Representative Nash. I will move your bill that it be re-referred to Transportation and Regional Governance Policy. To your bill, Representative Nash, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment, if we could move that as well.
All right.
That's the A-17.
Members, we have the A-17. Any discussion on the A-17? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A-17, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A-17 has been added to your bill. Representative Nash.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, you know, we all hear about working with constituents to make sure that we're listening to their concerns, and I have a constituent that is a president of a company that is a property owner along some of the proposed Southwest Transit line, and she's brought this concern to me. It's a very large concern for their company, along with many others. And this bill really addresses some of the issues that face them. And she's unable to be here with us, so we do have another testifier that is along that same line that feels the very same way about this. And in my promise to Representative Dean, I'll be mercifully brief. So I'd like the testifier to introduce themselves. I've got two testifiers with me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Mr. Coyle, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle of Larkin Hoffman. I represent a group of property owners who are in the line of the proposed Southwest Light Rail project. These are all landowners who have been longstanding property owners or tenants, all of whom will be displaced by virtue of the alignment of the line, most likely through the use of condemnation. We're not here to try to disrupt that project to the extent that it's going to go forward. That's not our decision to make. What we're here, though, is to try to encourage the legislature to support a change in the law that assures that these landowners will be treated the same as if MnDOT or Hennepin County or a city were undertaking condemnation. There's an anomaly in the statute that applies to the Met Council that we've learned about that, if it's not altered, would not only deny these folks the opportunity for some due process rights that are existing in statute for other landowners, but equally important, it would deprive them of the compensation that would be paid to those other similarly situated landowners, and frankly, there's no reason for that distinction. If a landowner is going to be adversely affected by condemnation to any degree, it's our view that they should be treated no different than if the condemnation action is initiated by MnDOT or Hennepin County or by a city, and that's all we're asking for in this bill. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dwayne Jabe, who is a property owner who will be affected by the proposed project that presumably will proceed sometime this year.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair. Excuse me. On behalf of my business partners, our employees, and many other businesses up and down the Southwest Light Rail Corridor, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to testify on this bill. My name is Dwayne Jabe, and the name of my company is Construction Materials Incorporated. We're located in St. Louis Park at Louisiana and Highway 7. We've been there for 51 years now. We are a manufacturer and material supplier to the bridge and highway heavy construction industry. And we've experienced many years of success at this location. Would like nothing more than to continue doing business there. However, we recently received an offer from Metropolitan Council, and it appears as though we will officially be asked to leave. Construction Materials is going to lose its current location due to the construction of a light rail station. The property will become a new parking lot. However, our situation is a little different from the other property owners. We will be left with our property across the street from these three lots. And with this remaining property and the building, Construction Materials cannot effectively compete in our market. So the only way for us to continue doing business is to pick up and move the entire business. We are a manufacturer, so the difficulty of moving the production lines, the equipment, and the inventory is the daunting task that we have before us. It seems very unfair to me that we will not be given full compensation for the loss of our business location, particularly when you consider the scope and substantial investment that Met Council has already made in this project. All we ask is that we receive the full benefit of the Minnesota condemnation law. On behalf of the Minnesota property owners that are currently being affected by the Metropolitan Council's condemnation actions, I would like to say thank you to Representative Nash for introducing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? I believe, members, just to draw your attention, there's written testimony from Mr. Judge Shetman with the MEP Council in your packets. Are there member questions to the testifiers? Representative Lash.
Well, Madam Chair, and I'm interested in hearing more about this bill, Representative Nash. As you may or may not know, many people in here know that I and my partners had a proposal to build a bar restaurant on the corner of Rice and University, that was all set to go. We had several problems, including the credit markets crashed after 08 and several things happened. However, the most major problem was the light rail line out here that goes down the center of University Avenue the entire way between downtown St. Paul and downtown Minneapolis, except for when it gets right in front of my business. And we were offered by Met Council Action Mindal, who handled this, compensation for taking about a foot of frontage on the front for that light rail, and then a 30-by-30 square for a substation deal, electrical substation deal there. And they were going to compensate us just for that. Neglecting that completely took our frontage. You couldn't get in or out of there. So they said, well, we're just paying you for the land we're taking. Well, yeah. Now I can land a helicopter there, but I can't drive any cars in or out of there. And I was flabbergasted about that. Didn't bring up any bills in this legislature regarding that. May have been worthwhile, but I would have probably had a conflict of interest doing it. But we did sue. We had to sue. It was protracted litigation over the course of several years, and we won in the courts. But it was an extremely onerous process to have to go through as a business owner. I get that. I'm still flabbergasted at the number of things that we had to do. And they actually waited to negotiate with us until one of the last people, because they knew it was going to be complex, because they knew that what they were doing to us. And it only makes me wonder about the other folks that have to go through this. In the name of progress, and yes, it's progress, I get it, but I do believe in full compensation for taking, so thank you for bringing us.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nash, for having brought this bill. I mean, this is very upsetting. I most definitely want to thank Mr. Jabe for being here and for putting a face on the impact that situations like this have on property owners. And the fact that your business has been there for 51 years, and that there will still be a piece of property across the way, which, you know, this whole situation is being foisted upon you, and you're going to have to, you know, relocate. At minimum, you deserve full compensation, and I just think this is egregious. Representative Nash's bill will hopefully begin to right this wrong, and I'm just so grateful for your having been here, and thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nash. So if we pass this, do you see this as being any impediment for Southwest LRT moving forward?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dean, I can't stop that. But what this is, as Representative Lesh alluded to, this is about making the property owner whole. And, whatever happens to the Southwest Light Rail line, that's not in my control, but I'm trying to stand up for the property owners that are along that line and try to create some level footing for them. Because if it was, as Mr. Coyle said, if it was a different agency, it would be being dealt with differently, and that's not fair. So what the long-term implications of this are as it relates to Southwest LRT, I couldn't say, but I'm just trying to stand up for the property owners along the line.
Mr. Jade, how many property owners did you say that you represent?
Not a specific figure, just I know how people feel up and down the corridor. There's a couple right nearby by me that are also being condemned.
Okay.
So.
Very good.
And Madam Chair, if I could, the constituent of mine that isn't able to join us today, their property will be impacted heavily. They own an apartment complex along the line, and I think the proposed build-out takes the line right up to their apartment complex clubhouse. And as Representative Lesh alluded to, that's not exactly ambiance that excites people too much. And they feel like they have zero voice in this, that it's just sort of being thrust on them. And that's really the implication behind this bill. So, members, thank you.
Very good, thank you. Any other member questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, I was just wondering if you happen to know why it wasn't included in the past. Do you have any kind of history as to why this wasn't already a part of statute?
Representative Nash?
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, I couldn't really say. I think that there's a lot of things that we deal with here on a regular basis that we find unintended consequences and things that we should fix, and I think that's really kind of what this is a cleanup fix bill. So I would appreciate your support.
Seeing no further member questions, all those in favor, I will renew my motion that House File 2058 be re-referred to Transportation and Regional Governance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As amended.
Aye. You got it in there, Madam Chair.
I think so, too. Opposed, same sign? You're on your way, Representative Nash. Thank you so much for your time and for being here. Representative Hoppe. And on deck, Representative Rarick. Good morning, Representative Hoppe.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Representative Powell, would you like to move House File 1732?
I'd be honored to.
Well, thank you. So the motion is that House File 1732 be re-referred to Government Operations and Elections Policy. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members, thank you. And Madam Chair and staff and everybody, it is nice to be back here at Civil Law.
It's good to have you.
So this is a bill, and I will be very brief. It's a bill that I don't think we're in 100% agreement on yet with the Commerce, and I haven't talked to Mr. Brickwoody this morning, but my guess is that we're still working out some of the details, but it's a bill dealing with market conduct and how the insurance companies are, how the exams are done by the Department of Commerce on our state's insurance companies. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my celebrity testifiers.
Very fine. To your testifiers, I don't know who wants to go first. Just please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota, and just a couple of brief comments, Madam Chair and committee members. The bill is a byproduct of many discussions and conversations between the insurance industry. We started the conversations with Chairman Hoppe even before the session, but specifically focusing on an issue that's just increasingly now come to be a significant issue for across the board, property casualty life insurers. And specifically, it's the Commerce Department's market conduct examination process. It's an important process. We support the process. We've worked with the regulator through the years with that process. But really what's happened in some recent years is that we think that there's been some significant deviation from some of the best practices that we find around the country with this examination process and some of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners guidelines. Those deviations have resulted in a situation where And part of that, Madam Chair and committee members, has been the Commerce Department's utilization of outside vendors, third parties, to conduct these examinations. And we think that's been really a significant factor that we think has kind of pushed us off the track, that the more solid, sound regulatory track that we need to be on and that we're committed to being on. And as a result of that, we're seeing some less efficiencies in the process. We're seeing some failures in the transparency of the process and some of the communication. So, frankly, we need to just help build those parameters into this important function within the department. And we have, Madam Chair and committee members, vetted this bill, every word of it, with the Commerce Department and the senior staff and the commissioner, and that process continues, fully vetting to really air out all the issues, make sure we're clear, they're clear. We want the process to work. We want the department to be functioning and doing the consumer protections, but you know, they operate within the duties and the responsibilities that you as a legislature define and put in the state statute. So really this is an effort in this year to help more clearly delineate those duties and responsibilities in this examination process, Madam Chair. So that's really the background on it, Ms. Rowan. There's, I know, some specific issues that are within the jurisdiction of this committee, and so we're happy to and well able to whatever extent that you committee members have questions on the whole macro bill or the issues that we're dealing with and any of the specifics, we're happy to do that. But Ms. Rowan will focus in now on those parts of the bill that are within your jurisdiction.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And to what Mr. Johnson said, I'm happy to answer questions about any provisions in the bill, but I'll focus on the provisions that are within this committee's jurisdiction. I would also like to say before I start that the dialogue we've been having with the department has been very healthy, and we all agree that there should be standards and parameters in place to make sure that exams are efficient. So I will draw your attention to line 4.12 in the first section of the bill, and this is the language that deals with data practices. And this language does two things. First, the market conduct statute was enacted before we enacted Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act. So we are classifying the data in a way that makes sense within Chapter 13 because it hadn't been that way before. In addition to that, we are adding standard NAIC language, which can be found in three other places in Minnesota statute, so it's not new language. And it's used to protect other types of insurance data, so you can find it in the Holding Company Act, you can find it in the Principal-Based Reserves Act, and you can also find it in the ORSA Act, which is the Own Risk Solvency Act. It's not the whale, because it sounds like a whale to me. And the public policy behind the standard NAIC language is that state regulators are charged with regulating national companies on a state-by-state basis, and therefore they're required to share information across state lines. And so regulators and companies alike feel so there has to be, it is imperative that the language is treated by the same standards in each jurisdiction and that the company and the regulator sharing the information knows that the information will be protected at the same level. In addition, there are strong protections around insurance data everywhere in the code because the department is performing a consumer protection function, and so they need access to everything we have. So when they come to our offices, they have access to all our computers, all our books, all our trade secret information, all our policyholder information, and that's imperative to make sure that we're doing the right thing by Minnesota consumers. So that's the explanation for the changes to the privacy provisions. Next, in Subdivision 10, this is one of the areas that we're still working on with the department, but currently the Department of Commerce can fine an insurance company if they're not cooperating with the exam. They can, and they do. And it's very motivating. But for insurance companies, we don't have any recourse if we feel the department has exceeded their authority. And so we are working with the department to set up a process whereby we can have some recourse. So we work with the department. The department suggested language that came from another section of the code, 78.22, that first sets up an internal appeal within the Commerce Department. And it's a very fast appeal. The whole thing would take 35 days. and then you would be able to appeal that to the ALJ. And that's where we're all in alignment. Where we still have a disagreement to work out is that we don't, currently the ALJ's opinion is just advisory on the commissioner, and so our concern is that it's not very meaningful recourse if we say to the commissioner, we think this is beyond, this action is beyond your authority, and the commissioner says, nope, we think it's, we're doing exactly what we should do, and then the ALJ says, no, we agree with the company, and then the commissioner can ignore that finding. It doesn't seem like a good use of resources or a particularly meaningful recourse for the companies. While it's a deviation from the way things are currently with the Department of Commerce, and this would only apply to insurance companies, not to all licensees, there are 13 other instances in statute where the ALJ's opinion is binding on the agency. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you all might have.
Member questions? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing no questions and no further testimony, all those in, I will, Representative Howell will renew his motion that House File 1732 be re-referred to the Government Ops and Election Policy Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
You're on your way, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Representative Rarick, and on deck, Representative Cornish. Good morning, Representative Rarick. Representative Lunan, would you like to move House File 630?
I would, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And the motion is that House File 630 be re-referred to Government Operations and Elections Policy. They're getting a lot of bills going their way from our committee. So, Representative Rarick, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 630 is a bill to reimburse counties in regards to child placement. This is a bill that was in the tax bill last year, so we're coming forward with it again. Give you a little rundown on what has been happening so far. Brought the bill forward. There's been a lot of discussion going on, ongoing yet. Right now, we have the current governor's language in the bill. We took that on in the last committee. There are some concerns by counties, tribes, and DHS. So we are trying to pull together a meeting with everybody to address those concerns. Right now, DHS's concern is that there's a perception out there if we reimburse counties for cases that go through district court, that counties will just feel that they can place all tribal children with no expense to them. But I believe the ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, covers that as far, but we're going to keep talking about that, make sure we're okay there. We feel that if we limit it, or one of the arguments, if we limit it only to reimbursing for tribal courts cases, that the counties will try to push all cases through tribal court, and some people are saying the tribal courts cannot handle that workload at this time. So that's what we're going to continue to talk about, make sure we have that settled before we get to taxes, because that is more of the tax piece. But I've been working very closely with the tribes, with the counties, and I really appreciate Representative Allen has been very helpful along the whole process. So with that, I will gladly stand for any questions from your committee.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Do you have any testifiers?
I don't believe we have any today.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Member questions? Wow. Okay. Yes, you are. Representative Rarick, any final words?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would appreciate your support.
Very good. Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 630 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Thank you. You're on your way, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cornish.
Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Cornish. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you.
We have House File 1209 before us. Representative Vogel, would you like to move House File 1209?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair.
House File 1209 has been moved, and the motion is that it be re-referred to Commerce and Regulatory Reform. Representative Cornish, to your bill.
Madam Chair and members, House File 1209 is a bill that would direct a vendor that provides services for veterans to disclose if those services were available at the county service officer, veteran service officer, for free. Basically, that's the crux of the bill. So if a veteran goes into a vendor and the service that he or she is asking for from the vendor is available for free at the veteran service office, the vendor would have to tell them. And with me is Mr. Tom McLaughlin, a veteran, and would like to testify towards the bill. I'll let him introduce himself and his background associated with legislation, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It is Chair Cornish. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tom McLaughlin. I'm the legislative chairman for the Veterans of Foreign Wars Department in Minnesota, and I'm from Mankato. And I don't know if I should apologize right up front or not, but there was some confusion last night on the schedule. We were told that there were 15 bills ahead of us. And so I believe Ben Johnson from the Department of State Department of Veterans Affairs was expecting to come over. And my son, who testified on his bill before, Michael McLaughlin, who is the Blueworth County Veterans Service Officer, has testified twice before on this, and he was unable to make it, thinking again that this item was going to come up at the end of the agenda. So I guess I'm alone today, but Representative Cornish pretty well explained it. This is a pretty straightforward bill. It's been on the State Commander's Task Force, which is made up of all the Veterans Service Organizations in the state and the State Department of Veterans Affairs, on our agenda for the last 2 years. And basically, the bill provides the outside providers who provide services to veterans, basically usually in consulting or advising them on their claims or veterans benefits. It would require them to make the veteran aware that the services they are seeking from them are available at their local county veterans service office for no charge. Minnesota has a unique network of county veterans service officers. Not all states have an excellent program like we do. They're highly educated. They're trained in veterans benefits. They're funded in part by the State Department of Veterans Affairs in their local county, and they do an excellent, excellent job of providing services at no cost. And the money that would be spent on outside services stays with the veteran and in their county. This is not a bill to discourage veterans from using outside counsel or advice for their benefits. It's just similar to maybe a property transaction where when you do the paperwork, they give you a disclosure form to sign, and this would basically be the same thing. So pretty straightforward. There's no any money involved in this bill, so I guess that's it.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, we'll move to member questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, I'm very supportive of the proposal. So my question is there somewhere a list on a website or somewhere in law that says what those services are that are for free so that all those businesses can comply?
Representative Cornish?
If I could defer, Madam Chair, to my testifier.
Mr. McLaughlin.
Basically, the Minnesota County Service Officers Association would have that list, and this would cover all areas of veterans' benefits, everything from educational, home, to actual claims for compensation.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I would just encourage folks then to make that really public so that all the businesses can find out what's offered for free so that they know how to comply.
Mr. McLaughlin, is that put on a website at all, or is it just only if you go to the office? And
A total list of claims would probably be on the federal benefits, because the Veterans Service Officer and the State Department of Veterans Affairs work directly with the laws and regulations of the Veterans Administration of America. So.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Representative
Ben Johnson was here, and he'll be here after we're gone.
Is that him right there?
There he is.
Mr. Johnson, go ahead and come on to the testifier's table.
You can answer this question.
And while he's coming up, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make members known that this bill did pass through the committees last year, and it got hung up in the Senate, and I just had it rejacketed, so it's the same bill that passed to the floor last year.
All right, thank you. Please introduce yourself for the tape, and if you know the answer to the question or know what the question is, we can have it re-asked too. Go ahead.
So good morning, members. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And to the question of a website, our MDVA tracks most veterans' benefits, but we work in coordination with the county veterans service officers as well as the commander's task force to try and track and coordinate available benefits. But I would say the federal VA and MDVA, there isn't really a comprehensive website with a list of every specific benefit that might be available. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Representative O'Neill, and then Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, I was just curious if you could speak to the civil penalties just a little bit and how that equates to other places in the law.
Representative Cornish or one of the testifiers? Staff, I'm going to ask staff to direct us to that portion of the bill, if they wouldn't mind, the civil penalties portion. Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, the civil penalty is in subdivision 4. It starts at 3.26. And the civil penalty can be awarded for violations of the failure to disclose when there's a district court action brought by the Attorney General.
Representative O'Neill, does that answer your question, or did you have a more detailed question to one of the testifiers?
I just wanted to know how that equates in other places in law where we're assessing a $1,000 civil penalty for not sending them somewhere else.
Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, civil penalties like this can vary from anywhere from a very small amount, maybe like in a landlord-tenant case, to a much larger amount. It often has to do with the size of the business that it's being levied against. It's punitive. It's intended to prevent negative conduct. So it relates often to sort of the size of the business it would be assessed against, if that makes sense.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a great idea, but I do have some concerns when you have, and I know that our CVSOs do disability appeals, but I do know there's a lot of attorneys that do this also. And I guess when I look at the two, it seems like some of the veterans that go through the CVSO and are unsuccessful, or then they go to an attorney. I'm just concerned that somebody that's already been the CVSO, went down that route, and now goes to an attorney, the attorney still has to, did they just ask the question, you've been to the CVSO, you've done this, or how does that conversation, how do you verify that the attorney didn't, or the person providing the service, how do you verify that hey, I did disclose that. Do they have to have a disclosure form, a signature? How does this process work?
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, Chair, Representative, I think there's a couple of questions in there. One, to the point of a CVSO actually conducting the appeal. Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs actually processes the appeals. CVSOs work with us to file the paperwork, and they're the point person in contacting the veteran about initiating an appeal if there's been a if they have a disagreement about the VA's rating or decision. MDVA works with the VA on the appeals. That's our claims office at the Whipple Building. That's their primary work. In addition to that, we coordinate with a group of pro bono attorneys who will represent beyond that. So there is a network in place of attorneys that are willing to do it for free. And the goal is not to send them away from send business away from an attorney who might be working on this for profit. The goal is to make sure that the veterans are aware of the free resources that are in place and available. To the question of a disclosure for the appeal and beyond, basically, this is the goal is to be a point of entry to make sure that any veteran who's accessing the VA benefit system is aware that there's a plethora of free resources that the state already supports in the form of the State Department of Veterans Affairs, the CVSOs, as well as the federal VA. So there are and I don't want to forget the veteran service organizations that have powers of attorney that also work the appeals process with MDVA. The goal is essentially to make sure that there aren't attorneys taking advantage of a lack of knowledge on the part of a veteran.
Representative Howe?
So what verification do you have? Is there a disclosure form? How does the business protect themselves and say, hey, I told him that the CVSO can do this for you, but he decided to come this way anyway. Do they have to have a form? What do we have to make sure they're not going to get charged $1,000?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative, the goal of this bill is to have the commissioner and the MDVA develop a disclosure statement that at the beginning of a relationship between a for-profit service provider and a veteran, that they have there's basically a box that is checked in that agreement, the legal agreement or contract, what have you, that they then have a record that says this, we've informed them that this is available, and they've made a decision to go with us because they think we could do a better job. And we're not opposed to that. The goal is to make sure that it's another avenue that veterans are made aware of the resources that are available.
Any other member questions? If not, Representative Vogel renews his motion that House, Representative Cornish, I'll give you the last word.
Oh, I'm good to go. Thank you for squeezing us in. I know it's a busy time for you.
All right, and I apologize to Mr. McLaughlin that things got moved around. When bills have a couple of other stops to make, we try to move them to the front of the line to get the ball rolling. So thank you for being flexible. Representative Vogel renews his motion that House File 1209 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Cornish.
You, Thank you,
Representative Swazinski. Representative Howe, would you like to move House File 1876, and the motion would be that it would go to the General Register?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Swazinski, your bill is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee. House File 1876 really deals with kind of a problem that all small businesses, especially those selling gasoline, face, and that's the issue of drive-offs. That's a small crime. Sometimes it's done by accident. Sometimes it's done on purpose. This bill has a very unique relationship. It saves, in the past, the Petroleum Marketers Association is kind of the collector of this information. So as you're a member organization, a member gas station, you have a drive-off. You essentially call up your association, the Petroleum Marketers Association, tell them what happened, how much it costs. They essentially go and do the outreach for you. So they go out and contact the person whose name is against the license plate in the gas station. And they go about the business of writing a letter and working on the issue of collecting payment for that gasoline. In January of 16, in the area particularly with leased vehicles, So lease vehicles, everyone knows someone that leases a vehicle. That information has been essentially cut off, where instead of the information of who is leasing the vehicle being shared with the association, now only the lease company, so maybe GM Leasing or whoever that might be, the parent company is the only information shared, and the association has to go through the lease company now to try to go after those dollars. That creates a headache not only for the association, but also for the person that is driving the car and that may just potentially made a mistake and thought their credit card read and it didn't, and they drove away with that gasoline. And so this bill works to rectify that particular relationship when it comes to data lookup, and then also the fee waived. Yeah. Last year, the association did almost 9,000 contacts. So that's 9,000 less calls to local police departments going after these funds. And so there's a huge cost savings by not necessarily involving law enforcement with these crimes most of the time, and sometimes just accidents. And that bill, we're looking to waive that fee of $4.50. It seems minimal, but when on the average it's a $30 or $40 drive away, you know, that's a percentage. Even that small fee laps up any potential profit that was left and the great service it does to build our roads and bridges by the sale of fuel. So with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Sudzinski. Do you have some testifiers?
I do, if we have some questions. I've got Kevin Toma with the Petroleum Marketers Association here if there are any questions. So,
are there member questions? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask a quick question. So are you precluding them from prosecuting these folks, or do you anticipate that a letter would go out if the payment is paid, then it would be precluded from prosecution, or what? How do you envision that will work?
To the testifier, if he wants to introduce himself and answer the question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Toman. I work for the members of the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. What we do is notify the person that was involved with the drive-off and try to collect the fees on the civil side. Nothing in this stops the retailer from being able to do criminal investigations if they want to with their in-house folks or by going to local law enforcement. So we try to do the civil. We create a case file for the criminal investigation, and then turn it back over to the retailer.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess what I want to make sure is that you don't end up getting the civil penalty and then seeking restitution through the criminal prosecution as well and double dip. That's all. I just want to make sure it's clear in the law. That's
Mr. Tolman.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, that's not the intentions.
Thank you. Ms. Olson is on the docket to testify. We'll let her come down from DVS. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Don Olson. I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. The Department of Public Safety provides motor vehicle data to various public and private entities who qualify under Title 18 U.S.C. 2721. As you are aware, access to our data is regulated and protected not only by federal law but by Minnesota law. The fee that is imposed when accessing a motor vehicle record not only is a source of revenue but also works as an incentive to organizations who have access to limit their inquiries to the data needed to combat gasoline drive-offs. Without the fee, trade associations would be free to look up as many records as they choose without any financial obligation or further verification that the record was properly accessed. We know from our experience that paid users do not abuse their privileges as often as those who do not pay. In addition, we do not provide this data to any other association or private organization permissible user at no fee. This could open up for future requests by others seeking the same consideration for no fee access. With that, I stand for questions.
Any member questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Representative Howe renews his motion that House File 1876 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Next on the agenda, Representative Paul Anderson. The House File 1511. Representative Whalen, would you like to move House File 1511? Representative Whalen moves House File 1511, and the motion is that it be re-referred to the General Register. Good morning, Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing the bill. House File 1511 is an attempt to update a program that's been around here in Minnesota since back in the 1980s. It was established by the legislature in 1986, as we were in the midst of a pretty severe farm crisis back then. And the program has been around ever since that time, the last 31 years, and it's been extended, I don't know how many times, 12 or 13 times every 2 or 3 years, but there's really been no changes made to the format of how the program works. And what this bill does, in my opinion, is bring it up into the 21st century to kind of account for what inflation has done to the ag economy and the ag input costs in these past 30-some years. Last year, the Commissioner of Agriculture established a commission to study the program and come back with recommendations. It was a 14-member commission with farmers, farm advocates, bankers, Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and they came back with a task force, which is the basis for what this bill does, Madam Chair. The two major changes have to do with financial aspects to the bill, and one of them raises the minimum threshold that a farmer has to have in terms of the size of his debt to qualify for this mediation program. The amount was set, again, 31 years ago at $5,000, and that's still the number today, $5,000. And it's my thought that it should be brought up to today's standards based because of inflation. And that wasn't totally endorsed by the commission, in all honesty. They said if you raise that number, raise it up to what inflation has done in these last 31 years. And according to the Department of Agriculture index of costs, that would be $13,800. And I kind of have a penchant for round numbers, so I set that number at 15,000. And they also recommended that that number be adjusted annually for inflation. And my thought was, we haven't touched this for 31 years, so I don't think doing this every year from going now forward would be necessary to raise it by $13.12 or whatever the inflation figure was. So in the bill, it calls for looking at this every 5 years and seeing what inflation has done to that number as well. The other main change it makes, Madam Chair and members, is again back in 1986, when a farm family was in the mediation process, they were allowed to draw $1,600 out of the account for family living. And again today, because of inflation, that probably isn't enough to maintain their family living. So the recommendation was to increase that number to $3,800 a month that the family could withdraw to take care of their family living expenses. Those are the main changes, Madam Chair. It also exempts any new debt from being subject to mediation for 2 years if a farmer is in the process of mediation. And it also requires that farmers have their financial statements in order at the time of the first meeting, to allow the process to move along the way it's supposed to move along. So with that, Madam Chair, just a couple of numbers to illustrate what inflation has done in terms of farming in these last 30 years. Going back to 1986, you could buy a bag of seed corn for about $30 a bag. So with that $5,000, you could buy about 166 bags of seed corn. Today, a bag of seed corn costs about $300 a bag. So today you could buy about 16 bags for that same $5,000. 30 years ago, the price of land, about $500 an acre. You could buy 10 acres of farmland then. Today, $5,000, at least in some locations, you couldn't buy 1 acre of farmland. I've seen reports of land yet this winter selling for between $6,000 and $7,000 an acre. So like all other industries, inflation has impacted agriculture, and this bill intends to bring it up to the 21st century.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Do you have any testifiers?
I don't know. We had some bankers testify in the Ag Committee, but I guess today I'm going solo.
Right. I had Mr. Skilbred on the schedule. Is he in the room? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Member questions.
Thank you.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. 1986 was a long time ago for a lot of us. I was in junior high, I think. So the only thing I knew about the farm crisis was John Cougar Mellencamp's Farm Aid. Okay? And I think I still have that CD, by the way.
Track.
So one thing that may be more familiar to us in the last 10 years was the similar incidents that occurred with bankers and the subprime housing crash in 2008. Is there any way you can explain to those of us who are of a younger generation, so we can appreciate the history of how this occurred with the farming crisis in the 80s? How did that start out?
Representative Anderson?
I'll take a stab at that, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesh. I was farming back in the 1980s, and the biggest difference then as compared to now, interest rates then were extremely high. I bought my first tractor, and I think the interest rate was 17%. So because of that, it made borrowing and lending difficult and paying back those loans. And the price of land really took a huge jump up in the 1980s, and then a lot of farmers were highly leveraged. They would borrow money based on what they thought to be the increase in land values, and all that crashed. And it was a pretty severe crisis then, but the big difference was interest rates.
Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Anderson, it was pretty much the same as the housing crisis. People leveraged against home values that did not exist, but that were encouraged by banks in these incidents as a way to make extra money and say, yeah, the value's there, we're going to make more money on this. Now, yes, interest rates were super high in the 80s, but they were super high on houses, too. I think my parents on a house they bought paid close to 20% on it or some crazy thing like that. I just think it's important to keep this in mind that when this happens, and farmers suffered a lot back in the 80s, and really I think it's fair to say have never recovered. Granted, the market has changed since then, but I'll be voting for this, Representative Anderson, but I just want to make sure that we keep our eye on the ball and make sure we're taking care of farmers and that banks are not allowed to do the same things that they did in either 1986 or 2008. Thank you.
Thank you. Other member questions? Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And unfortunately, back in the mid-1980s, I was out of school and running a community bank, so I can empathize with the situation and actually experienced the mediation. And it was a difficult time because there had been a terrific run-up in values and all of a sudden, boom. And this law came into effect, and it actually, it was good from the standpoint that it gave people a chance to cool off and discuss and in bringing in that neutral arbitrator. I compliment Chair Anderson's efforts on this because this thing has been renewed about every 2 years. And it's one of those things that was set to, you know, was going on a sunset. Every 2 years you have to renegotiate this thing. And it just kind of kept going and going. So I know that it wasn't easy to come to some of these conclusions in here, but it did need updating. And there is value in having something like this because it gets people talking. But I think we also have to recognize that times have changed a lot in those 30 years, and therefore I applaud your updates on this and bringing everybody to the table on what is really a difficult subject sometimes. So not in the form of a question, but certainly a comment and a congratulations for being able to weather the discussions and get something done.
Any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Whalen renews her motion that House File 1511 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way, Representative Chair Anderson. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Madam.
Members, we're going to deviate from the schedule or the order of things right now, and I'm going to present House File 1362. So do you want to take the chair, Vice Chair?
Representative Scott moves House File 1362 before the committee and recommended it be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Representative Scott, do you have an amendment?
Chair Smith, I'm not going to be offering that amendment today.
Very well. To your bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. And the reason I moved us to the deviated from the schedule is because I know that my presenters here today may not be available this evening, and I know that they actually have one of the co-parenting classes that they put on Tuesdays and Thursdays, so I don't want to interrupt that as well. Large numbers of children are born to unmarried parents, over 40% nationally and over 30% in Minnesota. This is a concern for public policy because the children of unmarried parents are at an increased risk for a wide range of negative psychological, social, educational, economic outcomes. For example, the children of unmarried parents are more than three times as likely to drop out of high school. Daughters of unmarried parents are more than three times as likely to have a teenage pregnancy than the children of married parents. Moreover, the number of unmarried parents are much higher for parents at lower education and income levels, which means the children of unmarried parents often face the burdens of poverty as well as the risk factors for unmarried parents. Fortunately, research shows that these risks can be reduced if the parents work together in a co-parenting relationship and if the non-custodial parent, usually the father, has a quality relationship with the child. From 2010 to 2013, Hennepin County was the site of a federally funded pilot project called Co-Parent Court. This program collected data to assess the impact of providing co-parenting support services to low-income parents who are establishing paternity. The services, including co-parenting workshops, social services referrals, and assistance in developing a parenting plan, were provided at North Point Health and Wellness Center in North Minneapolis. The University of Minnesota conducted a rigorous evaluation of the program, and one of the evaluators, is she here today?
No.
Okay. Dr. Ebony Rowland, I thought, was going to be here today, but there were some very encouraging results from that evaluation. Unfortunately, the federal grant has ended. North Point is in need of financial support to continue this program and to help them provide assistance to replicate this important work in other counties potentially. This bill would provide $200,000 per year for the next 2 years to continue the program. Co-parenting program staff from North Point are here to tell you about the work that they are doing and how successful the program has been. And I just want to say I went and sat in on one of the programs that they offer last Thursday, one of the three-hour sessions, and met these fine ladies. And also Rose, who's not here, but she was the one I sat in with the women, the mothers, and was very impressed with the program that they offer. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stella Whitney West, CEO for North Point Health and Wellness Center. I want to thank Representative Scott for supporting this and also for those who have also signed on for the bill. North Point Health and Wellness Center is a integrated health and human services organization. We're governed by a community board of directors. We operate a federally qualified health center in partnership with Hennepin County and also a nonprofit organization that provides social services. It is in this nonprofit organization that the co-parent court resides. We have an integrated model of care. and services so our clients and our patients have access to comprehensive medical, dental, behavioral health. We have an on-site laboratory, radiology. We provide food support as well as nutritional counseling, chemical dependency treatment, housing, employment assistance, also client, family, and parenting services. Our approach is culturally responsive, trauma-informed care. All of our staff are required to go through trauma-informed care training. And we focus on a whole person, integrated care. That is, we see people as people who have families and also reside in communities. We also focus on community well-being and health equity. The co-parent court, as Representative Scott has said, was a partnership not only with Hennepin County but also Family Court, other partners, the community-based organizations, and the University of Minnesota, which did do a comprehensive evaluation. That evaluation compared co-parent court participants against a control group over a three-year period. Even though Dr. Rulon is not here, some of the results that was reported in the evaluation is that fathers that completed the co-parent court, 85% paid child support owed compared to 69% of the control fathers. Also, fathers that completed the co-parent court on average spent an increase of over 58 hours per month with their child compared to an average increase of only 24 hours per month with control parents. Also, 69% of fathers that completed the co-parent court had a much more positive perception of the role of the fathers compared to only 31% of the control group. We know that this is a model that works and that the impact on children, families, parents, and communities is significant. We believe that with this support, we can continue to document this model, evaluate the long-term financial and social impact. This will also allow us to provide the type of documentation where that this model could be replicated in other communities. We thank you for the opportunity to present our study.
Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. I'm noticing that this bill and grant applies, it appears to apply, only to couples that have one man and one woman. My question is it your intention to only deal with families that are that have a mother and a father and not same-sex couples?
I'm sorry, yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to have one of my testifiers answer that question.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Sarah Lieben. I'm the Client and Family Services Director at North Point Health and Wellness Center. And to be very clear, our program is open to any version of a family. To give an example, we had a family in which the mom had actually passed away. And so we had the caregiver who was the maternal grandmother who went through the program and also went through the program alongside the father. We've talked about it. We haven't had... you know, that opportunity yet, but we talked about it. The only adjustment that we would make to the program, because we try to keep couples separate so they can have a truly integrated approach, is we would just have, simply have, if we had a couple of two mothers, we would just have them go through separate cohorts so that they could speak openly in each cohort.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. Representative Scott, the way the bill is worded, would it preclude any of the $200,000 to be spent on some of those non-traditional families where there might be a grandparent or same-sex couple?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I could certainly work on some language to accommodate that. Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier?
I do have another testifier, too.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I just want to really underline the fact that this intersects so many opportunities for our parents. The focus is co-parenting and the relationships that individuals have, but as Peggy Scott saw, even in our small group, there's the intersection of domestic violence, child protection, addiction, all these, child support, domestic abuse, all these
different intersections. And what happens is, as people come together and learn to co-parent effectively, it helps them eliminate or reduce their interactions in each of those areas. And we really find that that is important. We have support for both the fathers and the mothers, which is really extremely important. A lot of times groups help one or the other. We help both and really work on helping them focus on the welfare and the well-being of the child.
Thank you, Ms. Levin. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Scott?
Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's anyone else in the audience to testify on the bill. I guess I would invite them to the table if there is.
Is there anyone else from the audience wishing to testify in this bill? Seeing none, Representative Scott, final word?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just think this is a really good program. One of my goals in coming to the legislature was to help families, and I think that this is a really good program. I'm very impressed by it, and I would ask for member support.
With that said, Representative Scott renews her motion to have House File 1362 re-referred to the Health and Human Services Reform Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
We're going to skip ahead again, folks, to Representative Smith's bill. He has a testifier that's here from Mankato, and so we want to honor that person's time. Sorry to bump you again, Representative West. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. House File 1542 before this committee.
And the motion, folks, is that it be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I have an amendment titled A1.
All right. Members, the A1 is before us. Is there discussion on the A1? If I'm not mistaken, that just moves the enactment date. Am I correct, Representative Smith?
Madam Chair, correct.
Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill, some may recall, we dealt with last year to prevent the frivolous drive-by lawsuits for technical violations to the ADA law. Last year's measure came up a little bit short, where these lawsuits are still continuing. This bill, I feel, cures this issue going forward. I have a couple of testifiers, Madam Chair, that I'd like to speak now.
To your testifier, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Baker. I'm the Director of Government and Institutional Affairs at Greater Mankato Growth. That's our Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization serving Greater Mankato. I'm also here representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the coalition of interests and chambers from across the state that are listed on the backside of the handout that's in your folders. I'm honored to be here to support House File 1542, sponsored by Representative Smith, and to speak about the importance of passing legislation to help prevent abusive lawsuits that we've seen targeting small businesses in our community. Our organization is aware of nearly 70 businesses that have had suits filed against them in the Greater Mankato region alone. And this continues to be an ongoing issue, as just three businesses were served suits last week. The vast majority of the businesses that have received lawsuits in our community are small, locally owned establishments that were served summonses for issues that could easily be corrected. Most often, the alleged violations relate to parking signage and striping. That's because generally the individuals filing the suit will literally drive by a business and note any issues in the parking lot that could be subject to a lawsuit. There usually is not an attempt to actually patronize a business on behalf of the plaintiffs. And in almost every case, the first time a business owner hears of any accessibility issue is when they are served a summons. Here are just a few examples of the suits that businesses have faced in our community. one business owner had his accessible parking sign stolen. So he took the signs from a less frequently visited business that he also owns to replace the stolen signs. Meanwhile, the business whose signs he borrowed from was sued before replacement signs could arrive. In another case, the business had just recently repaved their parking lot and were sued before they could put the new accessible parking signs back up. In both cases, once the violation was corrected, the suit was not dropped or dismissed. From our experience with the small group of individuals filing these suits, it is clear they primarily seek to secure attorney settlement fees over helping achieve greater accessibility for disabled individuals. In Greater Mankato, the average claim settlement ranges from $5,000 to $10,000, usually just enough to make it less costly for the business to settle versus hiring a lawyer to defend themselves. These settlements often create a financial hardship for these businesses, and in every case, the money generated for those involved in these abusive lawsuits could be better spent addressing compliance issues. Our businesses have the common goal of ensuring that they are compliant with the ADA and the Minnesota Human Rights Act. They want to be accessible to all of their customers. That's why Greater Mankato Growth has partnered with the Minnesota State Council on Disability to provide access, compliance resources, and audits to our business community so they can take proactive measures to be in compliance with the law. But it is critical that these abusive lawsuits be stopped. We appreciate the work the legislature did last year to pass legislation to provide an affirmative defense and voluntary notice letter. However, it has not been effective in stopping the suits. The legislation proposed by Representative Smith would help ensure that businesses are notified of an access violation and have an opportunity to correct it before a lawsuit could be filed. I ask for your support for House File 1542, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. What I'd like to do, members, is go through the list of testifiers and then come back to questions. The next testifier I have on the docket is Todd Parker. And on deck is Bob Margot. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on.
My name is Todd Parker, Madam Chair. I own a Northeast Yacht Club in Minneapolis. It's a corner bar. Recently in December, four or five businesses on my street all got hit with the same thing. Lawsuit by the same guy, same attorney. I hired a consultant to see what we could do to fix things. And she said, some things we can't fix because I don't own the sidewalk. City of Minneapolis would have to fix that, a couple other things. I've never had an issue. I've been there for 24 years. My mother's handicapped in a wheelchair. We've been there, never had a problem getting her in or out of the bar. I've got a ramp for her. We got handicapped parking. We try to comply with everything. But my building's 110 years old. I'm wondering if once we fix the problems, we can fix other things. We can't move walls. We can't move sidewalks. We can't do that. And do they just keep coming back at us and keep suing us every year? So,
thank you for that. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Robert Margot. I own River Liquor Store in Northeast Minneapolis. It's a family-owned business for 71 years. I've been there 37 years, been an owner for 25 years. And in a few months, I'll be open on Sundays. My 37 years, I've never had a lawsuit. We run a very nice establishment. We have a lot of handicapped customers. We have beautiful access. I was sued in December on the same day as six or seven other bars, liquor stores in the neighborhood. The striping for my handicapped parking was not up to code. I'm inspected every year by the city of Minneapolis for my liquor license from the health department. Was never mentioned. I get this in the mail. If I hire an attorney, as soon as it was a nice warm day, which happened this year very frequently, $10 can of paint, striper, I fixed the problem. My lawsuit hasn't gone away.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. We will, if you guys want to stick around, we may have questions from members afterwards. We're going to go through, we have four more people to testify. So if you want to stick around, we may have questions for you later. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
George Shardlow and Ron Elwood is on deck. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. George Chartlow, Legislative Coordinator with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. We at the Council have served for 43 years as the state's primary resource on accessibility. And as you've heard earlier, we have had the pleasure over those 43 years of working with businesses around the state, especially over the course of the past year, on making access improvements. We find ourselves, therefore, kind of at a fault line here, neither opposed nor in support of the bill per se, but having some aspirations for what we hope the final product will include. Having worked directly with businesses like the ones you've heard from, their desire is genuine to be accessible, but we as an agency with a statutory obligation to sort of tend the heart fire, so to speak, of the ADA and the Human Rights Act in the state, feel the need to go forth with some sobriety about what the landscape would be if this bill were to pass. As it stands, the avenues that Minnesotans with disabilities have for issuing demand letters include pro bono services and obviously for-profit legal assistance. Given that this bill would leave in place the prohibition against requesting funds in a demand letter, we feel that that would provide a disincentive for providing for-profit legal services. And we do not necessarily stand in opposition to required demand letters. We would just like a bit more clarity and assurance on how Minnesotans with disabilities would have easy access to the issuance of demand letters, especially given that the bill as written, granted it does allow Minnesotans with disabilities the opportunity to represent themselves and not issue a demand letter, but if they do wish to issue a letter, it holds them to the same standard of enumerating every ADA violation on site, which if they themselves cannot get in the front door, seems onerous. We also worry about the possibility that this would allow for an incentive system where businesses would be able to wait to receive a demand letter before making accessibility improvements, and then do so without penalty. And ultimately, what I would say is that we would actually welcome a shift from a litigation-driven approach to access improvements to more of an administrative approach. We are in the business of making this a fully accessible state. We're not in the business of driving legal profits, but we... When we hear anecdotes such as the ones that I believe you just heard about misinformation in some cases from certain types of building officials, we would rather see those issues resolved in tandem with this bill. That is to say, if we are constricting a litigation-driven approach, we feel that there's some housekeeping that needs to be done with the way access is implemented administratively, simultaneously to ensure that full access is guaranteed. And I'll close by saying that we welcome this work. We are hurt by these lawsuits as well. If resources are going to be spent, we'd like to see them spent making businesses accessible. But I do represent a community that's been waiting 43 years for a fully accessible state. So we just ask that the final product makes it so that individuals with disabilities have a system that is readily available and easily navigated. So I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chartlow. Please stick around. Yeah. As we get through the list of testifiers, there may be member questions. Mr. Elwood. And on deck is Scott Butel. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. And today I'm also speaking on behalf of Legal Aid statewide project, the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I just want to briefly say and thank Representative Smith for tackling this problem and working so collegially with us. This is ADA Bill 2.0, and I think last year we hit the target, but not quite the bullseye. And I just want to say that Legal Aid is completely committed to resolving the problems and working with all stakeholders. Representative Smith has been nothing but accommodating to every side, and I look forward to continuing to work with him and the stakeholders to get to a place where we can get a consensus as we did last year, but maybe hit closer to the heart of the problem, if not exactly solve it. So
thank you so
happy
much.
To stand for questions.
Thank you. Please stick around. Scott Butel and then Joel Carlson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Civil Law Committee. My name is Scott Butel. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. The Department of Human Rights has some concerns about the bill as currently drafted, and we've been very appreciative of Representative Smith's willingness to converse about this as well as the other stakeholders. We hope to be able to work with other stakeholders as this move forward to continue to improve the bill. We worked last year with Representative Smith and Senator Dietzick on House File 2955, which ultimately was signed into law that, as I think Mr. Elwood stated, addressed part of the issue but perhaps didn't exactly hit the bullseye. So we're glad to be back at the table this year again and wish to work on that. So for brief background, as part of the Department of Human Rights work, we investigate claims of discrimination, including disability discrimination. Disability discrimination is the most common type of case the department sees, comprising approximately 30% of our cases. This is a growing portion of our work. I say this not because the cases that are being discussed in this bill are cases that come before the department, but to give a little bit of context about that this is a growing area of disability or of human rights and civil rights law. The U.S. Census in 2012 reported that approximately 1 in 5 people in the United States have a disability, and other research suggests that that percentage is even higher over the course of somebody's lifetime. As our population ages, this percentage will continue to decline. Disability really is an issue that touches us all, including all demographic groups and communities. Accessibility to business and other community gathering spaces is a key element to ensuring that all members of the community are able to fully participate in our shared public life. I provide this general background information because we believe it is important to think, in thinking about specific questions of accessibility law, to also think about this bigger picture. The bill currently would create a mandatory demand letter with an opportunity for a business to cure a violation without liability. We are concerned this potentially creates a barrier to legitimate claims, while also possibly disincentivizing proactively improving architectural accessibility as required by law. We are also concerned about possible spillover of this new standard created in the bill to other types of disability claims and possibly ultimately to other types of civil rights claims. On lines 1.11 and 2.4, the bill as drafted currently refers to 363A11 subdivision 3. In the final version of House File 2955, the third engrossment from last year, this reference was limited to 363A11 subdivision 3 clauses 4 and 5. This was a more limited slice of disability cases that would be pulled in by the demand letter. This was an issue that was brought up in another committee, and I believe I emailed Representative Smith about this. As drafted right now, this is a little broader, and that's a place where this could potentially be narrowed based on some of the conversations I think we had last year. We appreciate that on line 2.29, the charges filed with the Department of Human Rights continue to be exempt from the proposed provisions. We believe that our process for investigating claims is pretty fundamentally different than what we are seeing right now with some of these issues in the community, and we appreciate that you've included, that you've retained that provision in there. We intend to work with the bill authors, proponents, and stakeholders within the disability to ensure that the final proposal really helps to realize the promise of accessibility for individuals with disabilities while ensuring that these types of cases really are focused on accessibility. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Carlson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I won't duplicate the testimony of those that have come before me with concerns about the bill. At the onset, though, I want you to know that on behalf of our association, while we have concerns about this bill, we also have concerns, like others, about the conduct that you hear. We do not like to hear about cases that are settled where the underlying accessibility problem isn't fixed. We don't like hearing lawyers that recommend settling cases just to make people go away. We don't think any of that helps this access problem. So we're not here to defend the lawyers on either side of these cases, but we are here to defend the rights of the disability community to exercise their rights under the ADA, which they've had since 1990. And so we do want to defend their rights under the Act, and we think that this bill moves us a little bit further away from that ideal. And I'll just briefly touch on not the issues that Mr. Butel raised, because those are concerns of mine as well. Just definitionally, this doesn't match up with the scope of last year's notice bill. But I want to let you know that the biggest concern that we have is that you will find people with an inability to be represented by counsel. And the reason I say that, Madam Chair and members, is on line 2.2, where a civil action may not be filed or pursued by a plaintiff if, and then you read the conditions between 2.5 and 2.15. And it's our position that you're really putting the ability of the disability community to assert their rights in court in the hands of the defendant or the business or the public accommodation. And we think that that goes too far and denies them their right to access to the courts. If they send us a letter that says that it has been fixed, you've taken away my right to the courthouse for both future and past violations. If they tell you that it can't be fixed, they've taken away my right to the courthouse. If they produce an audit from a third party that says we're working on getting it fixed, I may not file or pursue a claim. And that's important because the fee-shifting provision of the ADA is intended to allow people to assert their important civil and human rights. And so inadvertently or purposely, this bill, as drafted, will make it difficult, if not impossible, for people to obtain counsel because you're removing their right to the courthouse. And that's what gives us the most concern. And we've had many conversations about the bill, and we hope that a solution can be fixed that addresses the concerns raised by the disability community and the businesses, because we don't like reading about these cases in the paper, particularly as it relates to non-structural problems. So we hope that that can be achieved. And the last point that hasn't been made, Madam Chair and members, that I want you to at least be aware of, whatever we do here is not going to affect my rights under the Federal American with Disabilities Act. And I don't want to inadvertently push all of these claims into federal court and away from our state courthouses by putting up such a barrier that we can't assert our rights under the Human Rights Act. Because that's what I fear that will happen. So we maybe have solved the problem here, but we've just pushed it on to some other court. And I don't think that is what we really want to achieve here. So thank you, Madam Chair and members. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Please come up to the testifiers table. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
My name is David Katroser. I am a practicing neurologist, a practicing attorney, and a member of the Metropolitan Council's Equity Advisory Committee. The obligations of the Minnesota Human Rights Act to remove architectural barriers have been enforced for 34 years, yet the architectural barriers persist throughout the state. And I'm not just talking about the occasional minor deviation, the faded lines in the parking lot. I'm talking about no handicap parking spaces in virtually every freestanding parking lot in downtown Minneapolis. I'm talking about the stalls in the bathroom at the University of Minnesota Law School and the University of Minnesota Biomedical Library, where a person in a wheelchair cannot close the door because the wheelchair doesn't fit. I'm talking about the City of St. Louis Park's entrance to the building. It was on a slope so steep that a person in a wheelchair couldn't safely get into the building. The Act is not appreciably enforced by any government body. Instead, enforcement relies primarily on lawsuits by people with disabilities. Most people with disabilities see the world as mostly inaccessible because of architectural barriers. So they don't complain because the problems seem overwhelming. We often hear business owners saying, well, no one ever complained to me before. That's because they can't get in the door, or it's so difficult, they just don't bother. They go someplace else, and that means their world is constricted over and over again. If they want to enforce their civil rights, the Minnesota Human Rights Act provides two methods. It can work through the administrative approach provided by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, but that takes about 18 months. And unless we're talking about a really serious problem, most people are not going to spend 18 months to fix the problem. They're going to go someplace else. The other method's a lawsuit. But Minnesota has recently become aware of abusive litigation tactics that seek to make money, not improve accessibility. Rather than prevent the abusive litigation, beginning last year, 363A.311 prevents all attempts to eliminate architectural barriers through litigation. That means my civil rights are being violated with fewer protections so a few abusers can be stopped. I found virtually no attempt to craft litigation to stop abusive litigation. Instead, in a classic throwing out the baby with the bathwater, the presumption is that any litigation is abusive and that the businesses that fail to comply with the law and thereby discriminate against people with disabilities are the victims. Would anyone take the same approach for a restaurant that failed to follow food safety laws or a manufacturer that failed to properly dispose of industrial waste? The Minnesota Human Rights Act is a civil rights law, so violations are discrimination by definition. Those are not insignificant nuisance lawsuits in all cases. A one-inch ledge at an entrance to a building is not a speed bump. It's telling me I can't come in. Would you accept a building with a no blacks allowed or no Jews allowed sign in front? And how can you accept what is essentially a no people with disabilities sign? If you impair my ability to enforce my civil rights, you've taken those rights away. The only fair way to fix the problem you are addressing with 363A.311 is trying to stop the problem of lawsuits seeking unwarranted settlements without limiting lawsuits seeking remediation, costs, and minimal damages. If you wanted to prevent abusive lawsuits, limit the financial incentive to a reasonable amount. Keep everything as it was before 0.3.
Thank you.
Keep everything as it was before 0.311, but add an amendment stating that any architectural barrier lawsuit must specify the violation with particularity, including the existing architectural barrier and the legal obligation violated, and allow a maximum settlement of some amount, say $1,500 or $1,000, if corrected within a specified period of time. Exclude from this amendment any lawsuit with damages due to a physical injury, not just an injury, because in this state, all civil rights violations result in an injury. Otherwise, an architectural barrier violation causing death would be included, and all they would have to do is correct it afterwards, and there would be no compensation for the victim. You would then retain the Minnesota Human Rights Act protections while avoiding abusive litigation. I'm open for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Madam Chair. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I know you have an absolutely jammed schedule here, so I just want to make a few brief comments. First of all, we really want to thank Representative Smith for continuing to address this issue and taking this issue on again. This is some of the worst lawsuit abuse we've seen in a long time, and the stories are compelling. We represent 11,000 small businesses, and I'm beginning to wonder, I think they're all targets, unless they don't have customers, unless they're the back, outside of town somewhere, manufacturing plant that rarely has a customer. I think anybody who serves the public and is open to the public is a target based on what we've seen. But we need to keep our eye on the big picture here. The most important thing is Minnesota allows a right to sue for monetary damages, and that's not being taken away. We are trying to set up a corrective action here where so many of these violations are very technical and almost seem meritless. We had a board member who got sued last week because one of the allegations is his sign was a foot too low. I mean, this is technical and borders on ridiculous. And as Representative Smith pointed out, most of these are technical violations, and it's not worth the litigation. It's not worth the extortion that the defendants are feeling on these claims. But importantly, that Minnesota law does allow for monetary damages, so this is a step in between to allow people to correct the problem. And if the business doesn't correct it adequately, or if they just thumb their nose at it, they will be sued. You cannot sue for monetary damages under the ADA. That is a huge difference that you need to note. You can sue for compliance, and you can get your attorney's fees. But if we did not have this monetary damage provision, I doubt you'd have serial lawsuit people running around filing hundreds of lawsuits over compliance. And so a big difference between the federal law and our law, and this monetary damage provision is driving a lot of the concern. So I think we've really, maybe there's a few more tweaks to come, but we've worked long and hard on this with Representative Smith. I think we have a good bill that provides corrective and responsible action. We'll put an end to this, and this is the year to act on it, and I appreciate you hearing it.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, I think we heard some compelling testimony. Will you commit to work with Mr. Petrosa, to try to get closer to where we probably should be?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, for the last 15 months, I've worked on this bill, and I have been in countless meetings with the people that testified today and also people that were not here to testify. And I'm absolutely committed to making this bill better. This bill is about increasing access for people with disabilities, and clearly what is happening right now in the marketplace is not doing that.
Representative Hillstrom?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Katrosa, you don't have to come up again, but I'm just wondering if you can give a nod. Did you say you're a practicing attorney and a practicing neurologist?
Yes. That was a yes.
Jeez.
Okay. That's a lot of time in school. A lot of brain power there.
Yeah. Well, I agree. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Katrosa Esquire, I guess, did give compelling testimony. Representative Smith, I know you work with a lot of people, but I'm a little concerned about, because we did work on this last year, and we passed another bill last year, and there were concerns raised about the bill last year, but hopefully the edges were sanded off of them. I have some concerns that folks came up, Mankato Chamber, I think it was Mankato, And NFIB came up and said, yeah, this is rampant abuse. I was just looking. I pulled this up and saw that, you know, as far as a survey of National Federation of Independent Businesses, it was ranked 68th out of the issues raised by small businesses as a concern. And that wasn't just lawsuits with respect to ADA. That was lawsuit abuse. They ranked at number 68th. That's below access to Wi-Fi. Was a more significant problem to small businesses than this. And so I'm just kind of concerned that we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater and restricting some access to these legitimate concerns raised by the Dr. Esquire over there. And I want to make sure that concerns like his aren't overridden. I don't think I heard from you testify before, Dr. Esquire, because I would have remembered, because it was very compelling. And that means to me that I wonder how many other people are out there that have not come in and raised their voices on this. So I hope that is taken into consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other member questions?
Madam Chair, may I comment?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, they are. That has been, we're trying to thread the needle on this issue. And there's, we've looked at several different ways to try to do that. I fully acknowledge that this bill is not perfect. And we are continuing to look at ways, the way that the doctor described, and some other ways to make this bill better. So there is a commitment for working on that issue between now and if this bill is able to be heard on the House floor.
Any other member questions? Seeing none. Representative Smith, you moved your own bill. Representative Smith renews his motion that House File 1542, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
You're on your way to the General Register. Members, we are in recess until 5:30 p.m., 400 North. Thank you.
I call Civil Law Committee back to order. Representative Scott, to your bill, House File 857.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment to House File 857.
And before that, Representative Scott moves A57 before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill. Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment? Is there any comments or discussion? Seeing none. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion carries. Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a Department of Corrections bill, and it allows data that is currently shared amongst entities within the Department of Corrections system to continue to do so for case planning purposes. The amendment there was just making it crystal clear how the data is classified. And this bill doesn't classify any of this data differently than what it was previously classified as private. And with that, I'm just going to turn it over to my testifier from the department.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Lonergan. I'm with the Department of Corrections. Want to thank you for letting me testify this afternoon on this bill. House File 857 is a bill to help the Department of Corrections move our case management plans currently, which is something that our case managers do, into our statewide supervision system. The data that Representative Scott was mentioning is currently private. We put it currently on a WordPerfect document, and so we're moving it into our integrated system so that when our case managers are putting the plan together, when the offender is going to be moving into the community, we can have an integrative system so that the agents in the community who are working with our offenders and also working with our case managers can see what the plans have been for that particular offender, whether they've been had mental health treatment, chemical dependency treatment, if they've received their GED, or whatever type of programming they've had while they've been in under the Department of Corrections.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? All right, thank you.
Any questions or discussion about the bill? Is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Scott renews her motion and is laid over, or for House File 857, is laid over as amended for possible inclusion in a data practices omnibus bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Scott, you move. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1596, and the motion is that it goes to GovOps, I think. State GovFi.
All right. Is there? There's no amendments, Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the House File 1596 would just allow for the continuation of the commission. On data practices, that commission is set to expire this summer, and this would just carry us on through June 30th of 2019. And the commission was a brainchild of Mary Liz Holberg when she was here, so that we could take up and study issues concerning data privacy and the Data Practices Act in more detail, and then also just make recommendations to this committee. And it's also just a really good tool for educating the members that are on it as far as data practices go. A lot of people know a lot about that area of statute, so that's what this bill does. It's just continue on so we can continue our work.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify in this bill? Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Also, I'm not with Minkoji, but I'd like to encourage you to take a look at a comment by Minkoji. Matt Elling gave you some testimony, talks about the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. The Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Privacy, I thought, was a good start to educate the legislature about what's happening in technology and privacy and information policy. And it should continue. Some of those things that took the area of privacy and information was actually talked about in the Legislative Commission first in detail: body cameras, license plate readers, the issue of email retention that is now being discussed. Can it be in a more effective? Yes. And that all depends on you, the legislators, who continue to engage in this commission. Over the last year, it was a political year, and maybe that had some impact, but there was not a lot of meetings, and there were a lot of issues that need to be addressed to it. I just encourage you, whoever you select to be as your commission members, and that's through leadership and congeniality discussion, these are people that want to get into some of these issues. Because they're not going away. And as all of you know, these are mounting and mounting and mounting. And unless you have some groups, which the commission does, to get some of these things and look at them and help you understand those, they'll just not be good for the policy for Minnesota and the constituents you all represent. So I very much encourage you to continue on and to learn what you've done in the past and make it better over the next 2 years. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else from the audience that wishes to testify? Seeing none, Representative Scott, the closing comments?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who's the chair now?
Last year, the gavel was in the Senate, so I believe it was Senator Kent was the chair last year.
So, I mean, it's been quite a while since we've had a meeting.
It wasn't for lack of asking. I'll just say that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Scott renews her motion that House File 1596
be re-referred to the State Gov Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lewin, House File 1443.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1443.
All right. And the motion is that this be re-referred to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee. To your bill.
First of all, I want to thank you and the members for hearing the bill. This bill does has a couple provisions in it. First of all, it statutorily protects the ID of mandated reporters on fraud that occurs. And what it also does is it puts in a civil aspect that allows insurance companies to recoup the cost of investigating insurance fraud. Right now, the insurance companies are bearing the cost of going out and catching the people that are committing that crime. They get convicted of the crime, and the carrier, i.e. the insureds of the carrier, gets stuck paying the cost of that investigation, and we're just asking to hand it over to the bad guys. The also, kind of a little more confusing provision is to remove the requirement for insurance carriers to report to the Commerce Department if they are incurring a fine from another state. And the reason we're doing that, this comes from the department, is that there's a redundancy because all of that information is already found on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners website. They've got it all already. And then finally, what it does, it broadens the definition of peace officers who are allowed to issue a warrant to include licensed police officers that are employees of the Department of Commerce. And I stand for any questions.
Representative Luna, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. At times, sometimes when you sit in committees like this, you come across bills, particularly with data bills, and there's little ancillaries to it. And I just have a question. Is the Peace Officer of the Commerce Fraud Bureau, to me it was just a different term, is that person a licensed peace officer under the post board with all accountabilities and standards with that?
Thank you. Representative Luden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifier. And I did check that out, and the answer is yes.
Thank you. We're on the same wavelength.
Once again.
Very good. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify in this bill? Seeing none, member questions? Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, and Representative Luden. What's preventing the insurance companies from requesting restitution as a condition of probation under the current charging scheme?
Representative Lunin.
Well, I'm going to break the question down. I'm not a lawyer, but for provision for probation, what would that have to do with the civil part? Probation, I'm assuming, would be on the criminal side.
Yeah.
Sure. And I'm asking a question I don't know the answer to.
Right. Well, maybe I don't understand your bill. You had said that insurance companies wanted to recoup the costs of investigation for individuals who have been charged and convicted of fraud. Is that right?
That'd be correct.
Okay. So when there's a conviction, there is a sentence. And under Minnesota Crime Victims Act, the judge may permissibly require one of those conditions of probation aside from following for probation officer, peeing in a cup or doing 10 days or whatever, that you have to pay back the costs you have to pay restitution. So if it's because you ran over a guy's pine tree or you burned down his store or whether, you know, you got to pay the cost for that. So what's preventing insurance companies from coming in and requesting this there?
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for the question, Representative. I know that as victim reparation, and I don't even know why. But I'm assuming there's nothing in the bill to prevent them from requesting that as part of the probation off of the fraud. But Mr. Carlson would like to come up and address the question. And
all right. We have
have two people that are chomping at the bit, Mr. Carlson and Mr. Johnson. So.
Yeah.
Are you guys?
I hear church bells.
Let's just stop and enjoy this moment.
The Kodak moment.
Smaller the room you get us in.
Representative Lesh, I'll set up the photo. Mr. Johnson, you want to come up here too?
We don't even need this on the record. These are administrative penalties. These aren't criminal sanctions. So it's restitution from the fraudster for an administrative penalty. It's not a criminal restitution.
And could you recognize yourself for the tape, please?
Joel Carlson and Bob Johnson. Together.
The dynamic duo.
Together, yeah.
Get the band back together.
That's all it is. It's administrative.
Okay.
Are you good with that, Representative Lesh? All right.
Yep.
Any other member questions? Very fine. Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1443 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you,
Representative Lunan. The next bill before us, Representative Pinto. All right. House File 1724. I will move House File 1724. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Data Practices Omnibus. Two-year bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's nice to be back. Hello, this term. So, Madam Chair, members, House File 1724 is a bill that relates to the Central Certification Program, which is a small business certification program that makes it easier for small businesses to have access to opportunities provided by City of St. Paul, Hennepin County, and Ramsey County. Members, businesses basically, and I'll keep this real quick for reasons I'm going to explain in a second. Businesses submit information to the program, and program decides, and then can be certified for involvement. We'll have my testifier describe a little more about it. That what the bill does is simply provides that the information provided by the businesses in the first place, tax returns, other sensitive information, is private and non-public while during the process of that application. And I want to emphasize that the exact language before you was passed not only by this committee but by State Gov Finance last term and just didn't make it to the next step beyond. So this has been approved unanimously by this committee and by that one as well. But with that,
Pinto, let's get something right.
Yeah. Pardon me.
The Senate screwed it up.
The Senate added some additional words, some additional verbiage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That was the right answer.
That is the right answer. That's exactly right. So we did our job, and so now we just need to pass this through again, and hopefully they will do theirs. So with the Chair's permission, I'll turn things over to testify to just describe a little more about the program so you all can all feel comfortable.
Very fine. Please introduce yourself at the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Michael Rosenfeld. I'm the Manager of Negotiated Procurement with Hennepin County, and I'm also the representative of Hennepin County on the board of the CERT program. The CERT program is a joint powers creation between Hennepin County, Ramsey County, City of St. Paul, and the City of Minneapolis in 1999. The CERT program was established to have a local certifier for businesses within the Twin Cities metropolitan area. Businesses that are located within the 15-county Twin Cities MSMA are eligible to be certified at no cost as a small business, and further as a small women-owned business or a small minority-owned business. The size standards to be eligible to be certified as small are based on the federal government, the Small Business Administration's size standards, which apply relative to every industry code. And in order for the CERT program to verify that a business, in fact, qualifies under that criteria, it's necessary for the program to see the financial information about the business that reflects their gross receipts, their expenses, and their receipts. In the case of a business that's operating as a sole proprietor, that information would be reflected on an individual tax return. This is the kind of information that we feel we should be able to protect so that because today it's our belief that there are many small businesses that are deterred from getting certified because we cannot protect that information. All the jurisdictions that are a part of the CERT program and other entities rely on the certification of small businesses as small business enterprises. There are other government agencies that rely on that. as well as nonprofits and for-profits. For example, the Sports Facility Authority, the University of Minnesota, recognizes CERT-certified businesses. The Minnesota Council on Foundations is an example of a nonprofit. And then there are many for-profit businesses that are interested in diversifying their supply chain and doing more business with smaller companies, particularly in the construction arena. All of the jurisdictions that I mentioned also have goals with their construction projects for the inclusion of small businesses. And it's critical that we be able to recognize and encourage smaller companies to get certified so that they will be made aware of these opportunities and that these governments can count their participation in a project. All of that requires that they be certified. In order to be certified, we need to provide them with the assurance that their private financial information will be protected, and that's what this bill accomplishes. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Are there member questions? Very fine. I will renew my motion then that House File 1724 be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. Good luck with your work.
Members, we have two bills that are not going to be heard this evening, Representative O'Neill's and Representative West's bills. And so we have two bills remaining. One is the Thiessen bill and one is the Lesh bill. And I know Representative Thiessen is probably not going to be here till about 20 after 6. I know he had to pick up kids, get them home, and come back. So, Representative Lesh, if you are ready for your bill,
yeah, I'll watch the baby if you want.
Well, Mr.
Oh, the wife is still here.
Mr. Collins was going to be here to explain this in great detail, but I don't need him if no one has any questions.
Does anyone have any questions for Representative Lesh?
I'd love to ask questions.
Oh. What time were you expecting him, Representative Lesh?
He was supposed to be here at 5:30, but he just texted me.
Okay.
I'm just giving you grief.
Now who can vote against that bill now?
Let's see here.
Yes,
Richard. Weapons. We'll be soon after 5:30.
Get the princess slippers.
Did you tell him 300 South? We changed names.
300 South. Let's see if he shakes the leg down here. Okay.
Can you do Thiessen's
bill? Yeah, I can do Thiessen's bill.
You're all good.
Oh, okay. Hang on a second.
Somebody might want to text Representative Thiessen and tell him he doesn't need to come, that Lesh is going to do his bill. I hate for him to...
He just emailed me.
Oh, he did?
I told him I can't, but he said I'll be back.
I did. Yeah.
You should tell that post, huh?
All right. So he'll be here at 10 after? Is that what you're saying?
He said I'll be back in 10.
Okay. All right. Was that a photo op?
Yeah.
Nice. She's always ready for her close-up.
This is her first testimony?
Yes, this is her first testimony.
Okay.
Where are the cookies?
Okay.
So, Representative Lesh, let's take up your bill, which is House File 1751.
Yep.
I understand that Representative Thiessen will be here in about 10 minutes. So.
10 minutes. Okay. Let me just see here. Do a little memory refresh. 13. We're doing testimony, okay? You're out of order.
Exactly. I'll allow it.
Okay. So here's the deal. This is the same thing that we've done for various other provisions, including for the health insurance provisions, where the Department of Revenue needs to have certain data classified for medical assistance program, DNR, deputy registrar, and MnDOT. So verification that sales tax has been paid, they can see that now, and it needs to be, you know, private. Data for verification that sales tax has been paid as an exemption on applied on vehicles.
Hey, you got to chill.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Lesh.
Yeah.
Let's move things first.
Okay,
I'd move the amendment.
Eleanor moves the amendment.
Okay, so let's move the A17.
Well,
All right, let's move this. Gosh.
Yes.
Would you like to move House File 1751?
I'd love to move that, Madam Chair.
Perfect. And the this will be going back to the Tax Committee.
Indeed.
So, and then would you like to move the A17?
I would, Madam Chair.
All right. Very fine. 2-year bill. Oh my gosh. I'm so distracted. Okay.
So it just.
We're going to vote on the A17.
Great.
All those in favor of discussion on the A17. All those in favor of the A17, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A17 has been adopted. Mr. Cummings, you're just in time.
Yep.
And you're having to compete with Eleanor, so
did you
make
get my
this
text
good.
About the room number? Oh,
sorry.
You didn't. No, that's all right.
I'm so sorry.
There's your head. Don't worry about it.
It's all right.
It's all good. It's
we're
all
improvising
good.
Here this evening.
We got to scare the baby. We're good.
Look, that's Pablo. Cool. Very cute.
If you want to give your testimony on the bill, introduce yourself on the tape and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We would like to thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill and for Representative Lesh for carrying it. To orient you to this bill, Madam Chair, the Department of Revenue places policy and technical bills for consideration of the Tax Committee. They are intended to be non-controversial. Inevitably, some provisions need to be heard in other committees outside of the Tax Committee. These policy and technical provisions were pulled out and put into another bill so they could be heard here and referred back to taxes. So this is a small omnibus bill with tax data disclosure-related policy provisions. I also wanted to state, Madam Chair, that we who work with the Tax Committee tend to think that we have the best committee staff, but Ms. Lehman has been very helpful so far. She's provided direct feedback and worked to provide high-quality service. So that is much appreciated, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I'll now go through the provisions in the bill. Oh, my goodness. So 2 years ago when a similar provision passed, Representative Lesh brought Shamrock Shakes, and I think Eleanor is one up in that. Madam Chair, with the amendment ensures that we have some state-assessed properties rather than locally assessed for the purposes of property tax. So this amendment states that specified information provided to local units of government or the state in trying to determine your market value is private or non-public. So I'll move on to the bill. Section 1 amends 270B. The bill allows the Commissioner of Revenue to disclose information to the Commissioner of Human Services necessary to verify information for eligibility under medical assistance program. Under current law, this information can be disclosed only to verify income eligibility for premiums under the Minnesota CARE program. Section 2 amends Minnesota Statutes 297B and related to a provision clarifying the Department of Natural Resources can collect use tax and refund use tax paid in error. This provision would allow the Commissioner of Revenue to disclose information related to taxes imposed under 297A to the DNR for the limited purpose of verifying tax already paid and issuing refunds. For example, when a Minnesota resident purchases a boat and the seller of the boat is not in the business of boat sales, then it is not a transaction that the seller would really be collecting and remitting sales tax for. So this would be considered an isolated sale. However, use tax is due on that transaction. The buyer then would register their boat at the local deputy registrar's office, an agent to the DNR, and later receives a letter from the DNR stating that they believe the buyer owes use tax on the purchase of the boat. The boat purchaser then contacts the Department of Revenue for guidance on the taxability. It would be really more efficient, Madam Chair, and taxpayer-friendly for the Department of Revenue to be able to follow up with the DNR to verify the tax has been paid. So we have the situation where taxpayers are told, go see the DNR and now go see the DOR when they just want to use their boat. So this provision will correct that. A DNR currently collects this tax when items are registered, so this is mostly a clarification of what is already done. Section 3, Madam Chair, deals with the disclosure provision with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And is much like the Department of Natural Resources provision. This amends 270B to allow the Commissioner of Revenue to disclose information to the Department of Transportation that is necessary to administer tax for taxpayers that own and operate registered aircraft. Current statutes do not allow for the exchange of information between DOR and DOT that would be useful in approving annual registration for aircraft that is operated in Minnesota. Taxpayers must provide proof of sales tax paid to the DOT for registration.
Excuse me one second. John, she has paper in her mouth. I don't know if you know.
Oh. Well, thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Cummings.
That's okay.
First things first.
Yes.
First things first.
Call me Mom.
For example, a Minnesota taxpayer purchased an aircraft from an individual who is not a licensed aircraft dealer in the state, and use tax is due on that transaction. The taxpayer reports and pays the use tax on their Minnesota sales and use tax return. In order for the DOT to register the aircraft, the owner must present them with proof that use tax has been paid. The taxpayer is instructed to print copies of payment confirmation from their taxpayer's e-services account. But inevitably, Madam Chair, sometimes taxpayers forget to print out their receipt, even though use tax has been paid, leaving them really frustrated at the counter wherever they are paying getting that registration. So this proposal will allow the Department of Transportation to verify that use tax has been paid when customers are registering their aircraft. And, Madam Chair, as this bill continues to move along, we look forward to working with you and committee staff and Representative Lesh. We appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and I appreciate your deference in me being a little late.
No worries. So, Mr. Cummings, the people whose data is shared, do they know it's going to be shared, the tax information?
So, Madam Chair, when they pay the use tax, what would happen likely for the Department of I'll go through each of the provisions individually. So for the Department of Human Services, they may not know that their information is being shared for income eligibility, but that would line them up with Minnesota Care. So I don't know, just trying to find out what that income eligibility is. For the Department of Transportation and the Department of Natural Resources, this would be on a per-case basis, and so they would be requesting that tax would be verified with the Department of Natural Resources or Transportation.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and my apologies to Mr. Lesh. Again, this is one of those situations. I am here. I see some language in the bill that raises a thought or two. You have to remember, medical records and tax records are the most personal information that a lot of people believe are important. And it's very limited to what is shared. So the questions I ask, if you take a look at the language, it's to the extent necessary. Well, what does that mean? When you take a look at some of the other provisions, because this is a provision in law that does not get addressed, or where there's a lot of language shared, or where it starts sharing. So what in the situations, what information do they want? It's a guiding point at times when I've worked with colleagues of yours and legislators, is to be as exact as you can be in the language. Because once you spout it, there might be a little bit more. And that's where we get into issues sometimes that whatever people may have some issues with. So that's my first question. Can it be tightened up, or what specifically are they asking for? The other thing is the Department of Transportation. That's a new nuance to me, where tax information is going to the department. Again, one of the other issues, I'm not trying to make this a big deal, but just general questions. You know, what happens to it? Where does it go? I mean, just like with any kind of sharing of information, more than likely it is kept as private because of the privacy classification. But, you know, just a couple questions here and there. But that was my main points, and as Representative Lesh would know, I would have seen it. I went up, but I'm not living up here like I used to in the past. I'm more of a part-timer these days. So when I saw it, I wanted to bring my point.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, are you to mean a bill to just tighten that up a little bit and making sure we know what data sets are?
Yep. We'll talk with Mr. Cummings about
perfect.
That.
All right. Sounds good. So we'll look for that as it travels onto the tax. Okay. Are there other member questions or anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Seeing no one, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 1751 as amended be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. By the way, thank you, Representative Lesh. Mr. Kennedy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Last on the agenda tonight, Representative Thiessen. Is it windy out there?
It's very windy. Very windy.
Representative Thiessen, let's see. Representative Carlson, would you like to move Representative Thiessen's bill 1814?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
All right, very good. And the motion that is that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus bill. To your bill, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the bill is fairly straightforward. It would require the joint, what is it called?
Mission on Data.
Thank you, that thing. That entity to study opening up legislative data and open meeting laws to bring more transparency to our process. And I appreciate the chair giving the bill a hearing and showing interest in the concept. You know, I have a separate bill that I introduced, House File 1065, I think it is, which would have made the legislature subject to the Data Practices Act and the open meeting laws. And just, you know, briefly, a couple things on that. I mean, one of the things is we have a number of bills moving through this year where we're telling local governments and setting requirements for local governments to comply with various aspects of the Data Practices Act. Including record retention. And I would challenge us to ask ourselves, do we have a record retention policy, period, in the legislature? And the answer is no. We don't apply the rules that we apply to every other jurisdiction, governmental jurisdiction, including the executive branch and including all levels of local government. We don't apply that to ourselves. And I think that doesn't make sense. And, you know, what difference would that make? Well, one thing is enforcement. You know, we're supposed to enforce whatever rules we have about open meeting laws ourselves. We don't. This would subject us to the same rules. This concept would subject us to the same rules that that local governments and local officials have to play by, including notice of meetings, including, you know, and then if we apply the Data Practices Act, having our emails available for public review. You know, subject to those rules, like constituent emails, there's separate rules around that, making sure that our public schedules are available so people know, our constituents know who we're meeting with and when. So these are things I think we should move forward. I will also acknowledge, though, that it's a complicated issue, which is why I think we should do the study. I think this is an appropriate step to take. It would be due back on December of next year, so hopefully we could take some action in the 2018 session. And there are, you know, complexities. The one real difference, I think, for the legislature, and there's some constitutional issues perhaps, but the one real issue for the legislature is that we're the only partisan body that there is, right? So local governments are nonpartisan, and the executive branch is, you know, one party. And so thinking through what that means for caucuses and our internal caucus materials, I think, is a subject we need to consider as part of this study, and I hope that that's part of it as well. But that's all an aside. The bill basically just asks for this report. But I think it's really, really important for us to do that and to really think through these issues hard because, you know, in a time of declining public trust, in a time especially, you know, with younger people, with most people just expecting information and transparency in, you know, from the private sector on down. I mean, people just expect that today much, I think, more than they did in the past. And because over the last several years, and you know, this has been true kind of regardless of which party is in power, so this is really not intended as a partisan statement, but, you know, we've also run into problems at the end of session getting work done, getting bills passed, which I do think tie back in part to the fact that we haven't had as transparent a process as we could have had. And so it's all of those things, and I appreciate, well, when the bill comes to the omnibus bill, I'd appreciate your support on it. But I'm happy to answer any questions people have.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Mr. Heller. Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, for the record, I think this is a fantastic bill. It doesn't say you're under data practices. It doesn't say you're under open meeting law. It says that for a study. And let me tell you, I've had fun. Sometimes, as many of you know, I'm always competing against people who are paid much higher than me, which is nothing. And so I remember working with a representative on a consumer credit bill. And they're getting all their stuff from the Consumer Credit Organization in Minnesota or from Washington, D.C. So I asked the chief author of the bill, can I see your communications about what you're getting? Because I'm fighting. No, you can't. Well, I asked a couple co-authors of the bill. They gave it to me. So it was very helpful for me as a citizen to fight some of the vested interests. I only share that as one example. I can tell you many. I wanted to know who's getting per diem. I want to know who's getting paid what. All kinds of things. And each house has their own rules, or it's very informal. Well, I don't know. Come back next week. 1974, or I think it was 74, or whatever, 75. When I think it was the first election in the partisan venue of the Minnesota legislature. And that's where they really cracked open sunshine. Now, I was around a little bit. I knew about it, but I didn't start hanging around in these buildings until 78. But I knew. And a great history, if you're interested, is a book by Tom Burr, who talked about how the closed meetings were and very hard to get information, and there was only one copy of a bill or an amendment or something like that. So here's another opportunity to do something for next year. Just take a study, hear from people, and don't be frightened about it. Again, you can set it in your own rules. And as you know, last year in the Rules Committee, Mr. Thiessen at that time, was Speaker? I don't know.
Minority leader.
Yeah, that's right. I forget. I should know that. And tried to get some rules going. Now, the question with what Majority Leader said at that time, she said, well, it's too late in the session and all this, we can't do our rules and all that. And I understand all that. And as you know, those proposals didn't go through. Then I talked to a lot of the IR folks, I mean GOP folks, they still think independent Republicans. But the old days, I'm sorry, I'm still not. But the GOP folks, a lot of the folks were saying, yeah, I agree with a lot of those things. But, you know, they weren't going. So I'm seeing this as a very nonpartisan thing, a respect for each other, and just to come up with some things that everybody can live with and be adopted year in and year out, whatever party it changes to, as it has over for a great number of years off and on. So that's my 2 cents.
Questions for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Heller? Is this document before us from you? I'm assuming it's got your name on it. Did you pass out this document, Mr. Heller?
Yeah, there's some yellow ones over there, but beware, the back page is not very transparent. It'll wipe off, so.
Okay.
But the front one, I rubbed on that don't come off, and that's from the State of Minnesota Attorney General's Office. By the way, my name is Rick Heller, unofficial representative, twice exceptional. Minnesota Statute 120B15, and the print disabled. This specific letter I was allowed to testify at the last Rules Committee last year in the middle of the session. I was here in February. It got filed and never got online. However, on the back sheet or the page that when I spoke on March 3rd at the Data Practice Commission, I provided some documentation on the Heller handouts that basically showed what the National Football League did, made their content more accessible based on Minnesota Statute 16E 03 subdivision 9, which state agencies are required to make content more accessible. And I believe, like I spoke in that first 6 minutes of the Data Practice Commission, that if it's not searchable, is it really transparent? And I'm a firm believer that even if there's images out there, the appropriate people, you want to provide fairness and sameness for everybody and for engagement. for everybody that has an opportunity in the public. This specific letter is dated March 17, 2015. If I may just speak for the first two paragraphs, because currently your committee does not provide electronic documents online for handouts. And since this is being recorded, I'm just doing an oral of what's in front of us. And with your permission, this is, "Dear Mr. Heller, I thank you for your correspondence received on March 6, 2015. You expressed your concerns about accessibility of certain records and proceedings at the legislature. Specifically, you have concerns about the fact that the legislature exempt themselves from the requirements of the Minnesota Government Data Practice, Minnesota Statute Chapter 13. In addition, you have concerns about the fact that the legislature's electronic records are not subject to data accessibility requirements, Minnesota Statute 16E03. You believe that the exemption of the legislature from the summary requirements affect the transparency of the Minnesota government. It must be difficult for you to face barriers when you seek information that you believe should be more readily accessible. You are correct that the electronic data records in the legislature are not subject to accessibility standards and require the state agencies under Minnesota Statute 16E Subdivision 9. Similarly, the legislature is not governed by the Minnesota Government Data Practice, but rather it has its own rules governing data access. Statutory amendments would be necessary in order for those requirements to apply to the legislature, because the issue you raise requires legislature changes, and I recommend that you share your concerns with your state legislatures." There's one that's in the room here, and there's Mr. Marty. And again, I thank you for your correspondence, and it's from Legal Assistance, again, from the Laurie Flanders. So the piece to this is, I'm glad to see a bill like this, and I'm glad to see that they're going to move along the this commission. Yet, to the author or to the commission, I think you need to understand what the word accessibility. Minnesota last year, as you go again to my handouts, they got a D-, but that had to do with timely only. But I believe that's an important piece to get access to that information before you can vote on it. However, can we make it, can we move it up to the next bar to provide more fairness and sameness for everybody? Because universal design principles, just like John's letter that is there, the Data Practice Commission provides more opportunity again for fairness and sameness and transparency for everybody. So that's my suggestion, whatever it's worth, on the word access. Thank you for this opportunity to speak today. And if anybody has any questions, welcome to those.
Mr. Heller, are there any questions?
Well, I have a question, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, and maybe I missed this in the midst of child care duties, but did you talk to anyone about why the legislature was specifically exempt when the law was drafted in the 70s?
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lush. First of all, we do have legislation and to deal with some of Mr. Heller's concerns, too, but I do think it would be a good part of this study if we move forward with it. I haven't gone back and looked at legislative history. I will say that the Minnesota Constitution has a provision in it that is about our speech and debate clause, which protects us. The idea of it is to protect us when we say something on the House floor that we can't be sued or otherwise challenged. But that has been interpreted by some courts as saying that also means that we don't have to, that we're not subject to data practices and we don't have to disclose anything. So I think that constitutional point may have had some part to do with it. I also just have a feeling, like so many other things we do, we probably just didn't want to do it. We have our own rule process and decided not to do it. But I can follow up on that, John. Representative Lesh.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So I just would point out that I think that's one reason why this is a worthwhile endeavor to study this. And I signed on to your bill, Representative Thiessen, that removes the exemption, but then you snuck this study thing in under it. I missed that. Was that okay? That was a little okay. Well, I'll sign on to this one, too. But I think it's really important to take a look at that. There may be some good reasons that I'm not even aware of as to why some things that we communicate about, we already know those, HIPAA conversations with with constituents who have a health care issue or some other kind of sensitive material with respect to a crime victim. It makes sense that that shouldn't be public, but that there are already provisions carved out for those in existing law, data practices law. So I think it'd be really worthwhile. What was the Madam Chair, the motion on this was to lay it over for possible inclusion? Or
right, in the okay. data practices.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, you know, I think that's a good way to go, Representative Thiessen, to study this and look at it. And because when all this happened last time in the 70s, all of the data disclosure laws were post-Watergate. They were in the years in the immediate aftermath of Watergate, where there was huge demand of the people to say, no, we want to see this stuff. And we haven't done that. And now many other agencies and levels of government have far surpassed us in terms of the kind of accountability that they give and therefore is expected from our constituents of us. So thank you for bringing it. I fully support this and hope that we include it in the bill.
Representative Lesh. Mr. Heller.
Yes, Mr. Heller, again, I just want to know for the record, I know over at Kiffmeyer, she's in the government operations, and Craig with the LCC testified, and he agreed that the LCC, Legislative Coordinating Commission, does not have an accessibility policy. And there's really no role here. As we all know, when you have concerns about accessibility or compliments, there's a link that takes you off-site, and it takes it a minute. However, they're monitoring it. But, again, monitoring and enforcement are two things. I think it's an important piece, again, as we forge ahead with 21st-century technology. Are we going to provide it in a way that's searchable and transparent? Thank you again for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Thiessen, you get the last word.
Nothing left.
Okay. with that, I will renew my motion. Or no, excuse me, Representative Carlson will renew his motion that House File 1814 be laid over for possible inclusion in the data practices omnibus. And with that, we are adjourned.